Philip Marsden is a renowned author based in Cornwall. He's not by any means an offshore yachtsman, but 2 years ago he set sail from his home along the south coast of Ireland and up the west, visiting most of our islands. His book has been getting rave reviews in the UK. Earlier today, he went into a studio near his home and told me about the Summer Isles.
Well, it's a group of islands off the northwest coast of Scotland. And I had a long connection with that bit of coastline. My aunt and uncle lived inland from the west coast, from Ullapool. And I was very close to my aunt, and we used to walk a lot in the mountains there. And there was a thing about looking out westwards into the Minch towards the Outer Hebrides, and always just in the foreground in the water there was this sort of group of scattering of islands called the Summer Isles. And with my aunt, I'd hoped to get there, and we sort of life intervened, and we never did. And then she died suddenly, and so it became this sort of place that I wanted to get to. And it enabled me to sail from my home in Cornwall up to northwest Scotland. But as a title, it always had this thing which was not just a place in itself, but the Summer Isles themselves have a sort of very evocative sense to them. And in a way, the book is about mythical islands and about places that we sort of project ideas and images and memories onto. And that sense of the sort of summer islands and childhood holidays and sort of lost lands, lost pasts for us. So it's designed to sort of embrace all those ideas, as well as being a specific place. It's a sort of imaginary place as well.
You speak in the book quite a bit about nostalgia, the nature of nostalgia, what it is. But before we get to that, you had sailed, but you weren't an accomplished offshore sailor.
that's to put it mildly. I'd sailed all my life, you know. In Cornwall, my grandfather was a great sailor, and we spent summers sailing in his boat around Cornwall. But it was always sort of day sailing. When I was a bit older, I got into sort of cruising along the coast, across to France, across to Ireland, but always in other people's boats. And there's a huge difference, as I learned, when you're a crew and when you have your own boat, and when you're single-handed. And I was sort of, I mean this whole book was sort of conceived from the imagination, from sitting in my studio in Cornwall and looking at charts and things. And I had this idea, you know, boats were always important to me, but the reality when it kicked in was very different,
because boat number one wasn't a great experience.
Boat number one came with my first book contract, actually, which was fairly modest, and the boat was fairly modest, and it was a little dinghy, and I think it was number two of a series, and I don't think there was ever a number three boat. It was a hopeless design, and pitched me into the water the first time I tried to sail it.
Overpowered, and you recount how the guy who was selling it seemed glad to get rid of it.
He was keen, exactly, yes. So I was too excited about having my first boat to notice that.
But when you came on then to do this trip, you decided you were going to go up the west coast of Ireland, across the north coast, over to Scotland. Tell me about the boat you bought for that.
Okay, well, again, I inherited from my grandfather not only a sort of love of boats, but a love of wooden boats particularly. And it's a slightly perverse attraction to wooden boats. There's a nice adage that I heard in a sailing club over here, that if you don't like someone, leave them a boat in your will. But if you really don't like them, leave them a wooden boat.
I know from experience that they are incredible amounts of work.
They're a labour of love. But somehow that they were the boats I was brought up with. And so for this trip, which was a sort of, you know, it was a big thing. It was a big sort of imaginary or sort of a voyage of the imagination as a subtitle. It was, you know, I really wanted to do it properly. And so I got I found, after quite a lot of searching, a 31-foot 1966 wooden sloop built in Essex, designed by a great post-war Scottish designer, Adam Buchanan. And it just had that lovely feeling of form and function, the way that sort of wooden boats do. And you never quite get that with fiberglass boats, the shape of the wooden boats, the smell of them when you're down below, and the sort of creaking. That was what I wanted. And Zambico, as she's called, she lived up to expectations.
You don't know quite where the name came from, but you have an idea.
It's funny enough, I got a letter just the other day from the son of the first owner. I knew that it was the name of a Byzantine saint, oddly enough. In Rhodes, there's a chapel and a sort of small cult to Saint Zambica, and there's a beach. This guy who wrote to me said his parents used to visit this beach below it. It's on the island of Rhodes, and I think they just liked the name and the memories, and that's how it stuck.
So did you have a lot of work to do to that boat when you bought it before you sailed off?
Well, as you say, there's always work to do. Not a lot. She was in good nick. I very much wanted to get something that was reliable. I was very inexperienced. I had no sort of. I mean, I'd sailed single-handedly to the Helford River, which is about 5 miles from where I live, and that was my full extent of single-handed sailing. So the boat had to be reliable, and there was odds and ends, but she was well set up.
You describe leaving Cornwall on the first day.
Yes, I sailed across from Cornwall to Dingle, which is a 2 or 3 day trip with one other person. And I'd sailed a lot, but never been seasick. And the first couple of days, in fact, the whole way to Dingle, I was sick. And I think now I look back on it, and it was as much sort of nerves as anything else.
One of the first people who came to see you in Dingle was Danny Sheehy. He's somebody we've spoken about on this program a number of times. A writer, a boat builder.
Yes, and a poet and a writer. He was my very first visitor. I was lucky to have a couple of contacts, and someone put me on to Danny, and I called him as soon as I arrived in Dingle, and he was there within about an hour with some vegetables he just dug up from his garden and a little bunch of narcissi that sat in that and thing. We sat and talked, and he understood immediately everything I was doing, you know, just the interest in wooden boats as a boat builder, the West Coast, but also the sort of mythology and the poetry of sailing and sort of questing in that way. That was very much his idea of sailing.
He had some words of advice for you.
Yes, he did. He had plenty. He was one of the ones who says, you know, always be afraid of the sea. If you're not afraid, you're not doing it properly, and he was right. I think sort of anxiety, that kind of fear that one has at sea, is actually the basis of all good seamanship. Just being sort of constantly aware with that slight edge, and that was, you know, he had this sort of dual relationship with the sea, when he felt enormous excitement and joy, but was also sort of wary and very nervous of it.
He unfortunately died that same year in a boating accident down off Spain when they rowed a Cork and Norfolk down there.
That's right. Yes, he was about to leave. We were both about to leave. He was leaving for the last, to go to northwest Spain, where he'd been rowing a Carrick, which he built himself. And yes, I got news of his death when I was off northwest of Scotland. That it was a real shock, as it was to many other people who knew much better than me.
You, when you left Dingle, you went up along the coast on up to the Aran Islands, and there was something that really had an impression on you coming into them.
Well, of course, the Aran Islands are always, yeah, they are the Aran Islands. I visited a few times before, but enough actually to be really nervous of that whole coastline and sailing up to them. I went from Dingle to Finnet, and then up to the Shannon to Kilrush, and then from Kilrush out to the Aran, which is it's quite a nasty bit of coast. That it's a long haul, but I had good weather. It was a beautiful couple of days, and seeing the Aran Islands coming out of the mist was a wonderful sight.
You're going to give me a reading from the book just about that moment.
Then, soon after midday, a distant piece of sea sky that was imperceptibly darker, a faint outline. Arran, the shape of Inishmore or Inishmarna or Inishwar, it was hard to tell. The name Arran anyway covers them all, used not just for the largest island, but as a generic name for all three. Arran, like an abstract noun, state of mind. What the island's great modern chronicler, Tim Robinson, calls the unsummable totality of human perspectives. Fanciful stabs at the name's derivation link it to the Irish Artuin, height above the waves, and to Arran, brother of Moses. The actual origin is more prosaic. It comes from the Irish ara, or kidney, and the word's usage for a ridge of land, the shape of the islands as seen from the mainland. I took a bearing, 040. I checked the chart. The shapes were not Arran, they were the cliffs of Moher. Unconsciously, I'd already edged my bows towards them. I reverted to the compass course. It wasn't long, though, before another faint shadow took form in the mist, and that was Arran. By the time I approached the islands, 3 hours later, the wind had gone. The water was oily and unruffled. When a cormorant dived beside the boat, I followed its submarine passage through a trail of rising bubbles. The waves themselves were slow and dead-looking, conceding their undulations in flashes of sheen and shadow. The glare was blinding, the whole world awash with light. I had to squint to see the coast a mile or so ahead. The low shoreline of Inishmore ran away to the left. On the other side were the cliffs of Inishmarn, high and cut off, like the profile of a bison. Between them was Gregory's Sound, named after St. Gregory of the Golden Mouth, a hermit on Inishmarn who chewed off his lower lip at the thought of his own sins. A golden lip grew back. The instruments were showing 40 metres below the hull. As I passed between the two cliffs on that light-drenched afternoon, I had the sensation that the hazy islands were not islands at all, but mountains. That I was no longer on water, but poised over a chasm, following a narrow path around the cliffs towards an unseen fortress.
That was how you saw the Arran Islands first. And then you went on to Inishboffin, and you told us things there I didn't know about its literary connections to Sylvia Plath and people like that.
Yes, I mean, the connection with the great poet Richard Murphy is better known. But he himself invited the American poet Theodore Rotker there, and he loved the island so much, but it brought out his own mental frailties, and he had to be taken off the island after a few weeks and taken to an asylum in Central Ireland. And then there was Sylvia Plath in the last year of her life, who visited with Ted Hughes, who was sort of already estranged partly from her. And she sailed across with Richard Murphy. And there's a lovely passage of her describing sitting in the bows of his boat, the Ave Maria, and looking down at the water and the ecstatic sense of this water before at her feet. And she was she died within 6 months of that trip.
You have a complete knowledge of all of these islands, including Richard Murphy's Ardilaun or High Island, as it's called. You might not know what High Island is for sale at the moment.
I didn't know that. How much is it?
I don't know. How much do you make from this book?
Beyond my budget, I think.
You spent a lot of time at Celtic Studies studying Irish, so you have an in-depth knowledge of all of these islands and of their history.
Yes. I mean, years ago, I mean, coming from Cornwall, I had this idea of living on the west and being drawn to the west coast of the British Isles, of Ireland, of Europe. And I wanted to explore that idea loosely around the sort of Celtic fringe. This was 20 or 30 years ago. And I had a contract actually with my publishers. I did a lot of research and I studied Irish in a summer course at the University of Galway. Then I got sort of cold feet about that whole sort of slightly tacky kind of Celtic thing, you know, which is a sort of construct. But all that work and those ideas sort of comes through in this book. And when you say I have an in-depth knowledge, well, not exactly. I mean, I didn't to begin with, but the lovely thing about sort of researching things is that you can go deep into all sorts of stories, and that coast and those islands are not short of stories.
You have the island where the children of Lear end up being buried.
That's right, Inishglora, off Achill Island, in County Mayo. Yes, I was talking to someone the other day who also knows the West Coast from West Kerry, and he was telling me how he had really good conditions and was able to anchor off Inishglora and visit the place where exactly the children of Lear ended up and being liberated from their life as swans. But I was only able to glimpse it. So I mean, so much of my course up the coast was dictated, as it always is, by what one was able to do with the weather, and I had to sail past Inishglora, which was sort of full of white water, and carry on to French Port, which is a little haven to the north.
You go in as well in depth to a lot of the mythology and the tales related to these islands. Saint Brendan, Brendan's story is one that most Irish people would know the outline of, but there is an incredible amount of detail there, and it was one of the most widely read books in medieval times.
Yes, it's a beautiful story when you read it, and I mean, I read it in translation, but I mean, there are several very good translations, and it's a lovely sense, like so much of those sort of like the Odyssey, so much of those sort of sea stories, which have both the sort of reality of being at sea and being in boats and exposure, but also these sort of weird and extraordinary sort of surreal details and stories. And St. Brendan is it's a lovely story. In a way, one of the things I was exploring in this book was the way that the west coast of Ireland and the west coast of Scotland and Europe as a whole has a sort of mythological capacity to generate stories and hold our sort of imaginary ideas. And exploring it by boat, as St. Brendan did, as many people have, has that sort of ambiguity of the real and the practical, with the mythical, with the great ocean to the west, and the ideas that one can sort of hang on it.
And with that in mind, when you went on then onto the islands of Scotland, you see those as a continuation of what we have here in Ireland.
Well, in a way, I mean, there's huge links in all sorts of ways, geologically, genetically. There's some interesting genetics that have shown how close the people are in the north of Scotland and the north of Ireland, way back, you know, connections. And I think those, and linguistically, Gaelic and Irish are very close. Historically, there's been a sort of very close links between the coastline and the islands of Scotland, and so yes, I was exploring in a way that the west coast of Ireland, of Scotland, are alike in so many ways, but a lot of people have noticed this in the book. Actually, my heart was lost to the west coast of Ireland, and the west coast of Scotland is wonderful in its way, but it doesn't quite have the kind of magic of the west of Ireland and the communities there, and things happen in a different way. You know, the structure of this journey was to sort of turn up and, you know, meet people, chase up stories, and, you know, you're reliant on chance in a way. And I just found that in the west of Ireland, things happened. You know, I got into conversations with people, and it did happen in the west coast of Scotland, but not in quite such a sort of wonderful way.
It's a stunning book, The Summer Isles, A Voyage of the Imagination by Philip Marsden. And Philip, you're coming to Dublin next month.
Yes, I am, to the Mountains of Sea Festival at the end of March. I'm doing an illustrated talk about the book and about the journey there. I think later in the year, Dingle and out to the southwest.
The return to Dingle.
Yes.
They'd be waiting for you with open arms.
Absolutely. I look forward to it.
And Philip Marsden's book, The Summer Isles, A Voyage of the Imagination, is published by Granta. A Kindle edition is also available online. Next weekend, on February 15th and 16th, sees the Irish Angling Show run again in Swords in County Dublin. It's the biggest show of its kind in the country, and Hugh Bonner from Mara Media told me all about it.
The show itself has been running, must be coming up in 19 years.
It's hugely successful for you and for the exhibitors.
Yeah, it has been. I think the fact that we have it penciled into the same dates, usually in around mid-February every year, the timing's quite good, and the people seem to just switch on that the show is on the second weekend of February, and we always, always get a good crowd and a good turnout, you know.
I've been out there on a Saturday. There's practically a queue to get in there on Saturday morning.
Yeah, that's always the fun part, because believe me, as an event organiser, the one thing you want and you need is people coming through the door, and to see maybe a couple of hundred people queued up outside and there's still maybe 15, 20 minutes before we even open the door on a cold, blustery Saturday morning is always a good sight.
What do you have lined up now for next weekend?
I probably could start what the IFI, one of our sponsors of the show, are coming. They've been doing the family zone there for a number of years, but this year they're doing something slightly different. They're trying to get more ladies into fishing, and they have they're launching a scheme titled Ladies Try Fishing Initiative 2020. So the IFI is planning to encourage more ladies to enjoy the benefits of angling. Plan is to run a number of taster days on the rivers Blackwater, Shannon and the Moy. And one of the guides in this, and they're partnered up with Glenda Powell, who you probably know yourself, who is vast experience as a coach.
She's on the Blackwater, River Blackwater in Cork.
And she's at our show every year, and she's most helpful, you know, giving people casting lessons and stuff like that. And any ladies that want information or whatever, you know, will get all that on the stand of the IFI, and also Glenda will be there too.
Now, you have a lot of experts come along and give talks and demonstrations.
We are delighted to have Paul Young coming along. Would be probably well known for his fishing series, Hooked on Fishing. And he's been presenting that programme on TV for a long time, and he'd be a very well-known household name. So he's coming along this year. And we have another expert, Paul Proctor, another angling journalist, coming along. It's a first time to the show, and we have Scott McKenzie, and we have Howell Morgan, as usual, who'll be the MC, and his daughter Tanya is coming along with him. She's just won the Welsh Angling Championship Lady Female. She's only 15. And we also have then Stalwarts, who are always get the crowds. We have Glenda, again, as she's involved in this Ladies Try Fishing Initiative. And we have Jim Clohessy, Jim the Sea Angling Expert, who always delivers, and always, you know, when the theatre has a packed house, colourful character, Cork Harbour, knows his stuff, and just a great character. So we've all the experts of the day. We also then have a kids zone again this year. We're calling it sort of the Crafty Catcher, Fishing Fun for Kids. And we'll have our course experts, Carl Hughes and Philip Jackson. They will be running that as per the last number of years. And again, it's to get kids involved in fishing.
And all of these people you mentioned, these well-known people in the angling world, they do demonstrations because you have a casting pool in the middle of the exhibition centre.
Yeah, that's right. We have two things. We have the casting pool, which is built down the centre of the whole exhibition centre, which is erected on the Wednesday and taken down immediately after the show, but it's there for particularly for a casting demonstrations. And then we have a little section at the back of the hall also called Pole Cupping Competition, which would be what Carl and Philip would be running, the Crafty Catcher, which is, you know, pole cupping competition. These guys are course fishermen, so it's to teach you the basics of course fishing.
What type of exhibitors do you have? You usually have a very large number.
Yeah, we have. And the mix this year, we've actually, what we've noticed this year, we have a lot more companies coming to us too who are into the boats and kayaks and sea boats and, you know, all different rafts and outboard engines and people like that. So I think that people must be spending a few pound again. Maybe they're buying a few boats and a few outboards, and maybe they're renewing the equipment that hasn't been renewed since 10 years ago or something. So we have a number of new companies. We have RLS boats coming. We have Conway Angling Craft. We have Warrior Boats, MCA Boats. We have O'Sullivan Marine Boats, Arrow Boats. you know, we've all the usual tackle dealers there too. So I think the mix this year is particularly nice, that from the point of view of walking around and touch and feel, there'll be a lot of stuff on display, which is going to be visually nice and for people to come around and walk on or look at, you know.
And the Ireland Angling Show opens tomorrow week. It's in the National Swords Arena near Dublin Airport. Opening time is 10 o'clock.